Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're digging into the meat of Pastor Dickey's The Problems with Atheism book. I don't think it'll be necessary to watch these videos in the proper order, given how this guy's writing style could best be described as playing a video game that just presents bad Christian apologetics, but with the randomizer turned on. Now that said, I am playing apologetics bingo with this book, so if you want to keep track of my bingo progress, then watching in order will be easiest, and I'll leave a card to a playlist that I've made that'll accomplish that for you. Anyway, this is what the bingo squares look like just after the introduction. We're covering chapters 1 and 2 today, and the rate of squares accumulated drops off significantly here, which, I mean, I suppose the intro would naturally hit more of the squares, as ideally an intro is an outline of what you're going to be covering in the book, so in theory we should be pretty close to finish with how many squares we can get. But I still have hope for a full square bingo before we're done, so let's see what he's got for us today. Chapter 1 is titled, The Atheist Must Deny What He Knows in His Heart is True, and it opens essentially with a look at the trees style passage, explaining that the evidence for God is pretty things in nature. No mention of all the hideous things in nature and what that might be evidence for, but I'm sure we can all guess at this point. If it's pretty, it's proof of God. If it's ugly, it's proof of the fall of man bringing sin and imperfection into God's perfect world, and therefore is also proof of God. At this point, he says, many atheists claim there's not enough evidence to convince them there is a God, but the Bible tells us differently. Which doesn't really help those of us who don't believe the Bible. Who cares if the Bible says there's enough evidence for me to believe? I'm saying that, as of right now, I have not seen sufficient evidence to convince me that the Christian God exists. How much evidence will be sufficient will be different for different people, so to just make a blanket statement that there just is sufficient evidence for everyone, without actually providing any of that evidence, is unhelpful at best, and at worst shows a clear lack of understanding of the nature of, well, just people, I guess. Because not everyone will be convinced by the same thing. There's a whole host of things that will play into a person's likelihood of being convinced by a particular piece of evidence. Their personality, the mood they happen to be in at the moment that they receive it, their life experiences, how this claim compares to other claims that they already believe, and so on. But at any rate, at this point we are at an impasse. I have said, show me your evidence for God. He has responded with, the Bible says you already know the evidence for God. If we leave it here, then I just end up not believing in God. Because if the Bible says that I already have enough evidence to believe, but I know that I have not received enough evidence to believe, then that pretty definitively proves that the Bible cannot be right. Or at least it does so to me. So, yeah, this impasse isn't really an impasse. It's a loss for the person making the claim. Because that's how these things work. If you claim something, it's on you to provide evidence for that claim. I do not have to refute a claim that is made without evidence. It's the Hitchens razor. That which can be asserted without evidence can be dismissed without evidence. But he goes on to quote Romans 1:20, which is the verse that basically says that there's enough evidence for God that nobody has an excuse to not believe in God, but it fails to actually provide any of the evidence beyond the look at the trees level. But at this point, Pastor Dickey says something interesting that I have very rarely heard explicitly stated in this way. He says that not only do we have enough evidence that we should believe in God, but that the so they are without excuse part of the verse basically says that we have enough innate knowledge to conclude that it is specifically the God of Christianity, not just an unknown deity. This is interesting to me because one of my typical responses to Romans 1:20 has been to point out that the verse very heavily implies that we don't just have knowledge of any old God, we have knowledge specifically of the Christian God, and if we are without excuse, then it has to be at least enough knowledge that we could come to salvation in Jesus without ever hearing about Christianity from an outside source. And if that is the case, then we would expect that, at least occasionally, but realistically probably in most cases, Christianity would be found existing in cultures that had never had any previous experience with it. And yet, this has never once happened. In the entire history of Christianity, it has only ever spread through people telling other people about it, as we would expect of any religion that isn't true. But if God really did exist and let everyone know that he exists in enough detail that they could come to a saving knowledge of him, then cultures that don't spontaneously develop Christianity should be the exception rather than the rule. Also, this gets us the everyone knows God exists bingo square. And that's the end of chapter one. It's a measly 2 pages and presented zero evidence for God, focusing instead on claiming that everyone already knows that God exists. Which, fair point, that is basically what the title said it would be about, so I shouldn't really be surprised? Chapter 2 is titled, There Are a Number of Things an Atheist Cannot Account For, and opens with the sentence, The atheist lives in a world where he claims the only thing that exists is matter. Which is just flat out not true. Things that exist that are not matter include, but are not limited to, energy, time, and gravity.
What is mind? No matter. What is matter? Never mind.
Now, I know he's going to spend this chapter attacking the general concept of naturalism, but him so drastically misunderstanding what naturalism is right in the first sentence does not bode well for what is to come. And his second sentence gets us back to the fact that he can't even keep his own definition of atheism straight. If you'll recall, in the intro he kept flip-flopping between atheism being a rejection of the God that they actually do believe in, and actual disbelief in God. In chapter 1, we stayed pretty firmly in the atheists really do believe in God, they just reject him definition, but by sentence 2 of this chapter, we get to atheists do not accept the possibility that a personal, transcendent, and immaterial God could exist. To which I would ask, what's the difference between believing that a God's existence is not possible and actually not believing in that God? Is he trying to say that we reject the possibility that God could exist, but somehow still believe in God? Because that's just nonsense. But it gets worse. In the opening sentence, a charitable interpretation is that he doesn't understand enough about atheism to accurately describe their beliefs, because I've never met an atheist that thinks that matter is actually the only thing that exists. But as it turns out, we now learn that it's not that he doesn't understand atheism, although he clearly doesn't, but his comment about only believing in matter turns out to be wrong more because he doesn't seem to know what matter is. He says God, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy are all immaterial, therefore none of them can exist. Pastor Dickey, you do realize that if any of those beings existed, with the exception of God, they would in fact be material beings? The reason we don't believe they exist has nothing to do with whether or not they're material, but if they did exist, they would be material, but would be doing things that are impossible for material beings to do. I mean, there's also the complete lack of evidence. Like, I can tell you for certain that the Tooth Fairy does not exist, because on the occasions when I forget to swap out my kid's lost tooth for money in the night, it's still a tooth in the morning. If I don't buy presents from Santa for my kids at Christmas, they don't appear during the night without my input. That's actually one of the biggest plot holes in most Santa-themed movies. They almost always make a point of showing that the adults don't believe in Santa, it's the kids who believe in Santa. But in these movies, Santa is always real, which means that adults don't believe in the guy that drops free shit off for their kids once a year. I want to know, in the canon of those movies, where do the adults think that those presents come from? But that's what's weird here. I mean, no, his understanding of what material means is weird, but that aside, the weird thing is that if I had evidence that Santa existed and everyone I knew had the universal experience of presents for their kids materializing under the tree every Christmas Eve, with the presents matching what they asked that guy at the mall for, with occasional Santa sightings and reindeer and sleigh tracks showing up on the roof when it's snowy, stuff like that, then I'd probably believe in Santa. Now, he claims that I have sufficient evidence to believe not only in God, but specifically in the Christian God, and yet I do not believe in that God, despite his protestations to the contrary. At this point, he changes the subject fast enough to give you whiplash to say that atheists cannot account for logic, words, reason, and cognitive thought. And I'm tempted to agree with him. Reading this book has left me doubting the existence of all of those things. It's really quite the existential crisis. But really, what it comes to is a single question. Why not? Why can words not exist if God doesn't exist? Logic is just a tool that humans invented to describe how the universe works, so it seems to me that the existence of logic is dependent on the existence of humans rather than God. Unless by logic you actually mean how the universe works, in which case we're close to grabbing the fine-tuning square, but that wasn't quite explicit enough for me to count it. But anyway, he says that only the Christian worldview of an immaterial God who transcends time and space can account for logic, cognitive thought, and reason. To which I ask again, why? So far, this chapter just gets dismissed by asking why. There's no real reason given, it's just assumed that this is the case, and it will be obvious that this is the case. It seems to be that he's under the impression that immaterial things can only ever be described in terms of other immaterial things. But even then, why a god, and why specifically the Christian one? Why can other immaterial gods not explain those things? Why can there not be an immaterial explanation other than a god? But really, logic is, as I already stated, just a tool that humans invented to explain how the universe works. The universe, in case you hadn't noticed, is material in nature. And at this point, I'm transitioning to the philosophical use of the word immaterial, which Pastor Dickey is attempting to use, but failing because he doesn't seem capable of grasping nuance. In philosophy, something is immaterial when its existence is independent of the physical world. Sort of. As with all things in philosophy, there is some disagreement about what exactly is meant, but importantly, philosophers generally distinguish between two ways one can use the term. In an ontological sense, which would include spiritual things like God, angels, souls, etc., and in the epistemological sense, to refer to something like knowledge or abstract concepts. So when an apologist says that we need God in order to explain immaterial things, there's some equivocation going on. What they're really saying is we need a spiritual being in order to adequately explain the existence of abstract concepts. But I fail to see why that would be the case. Why do we need a spiritual being to explain the fact that the operation of the universe can be described linguistically using the abstract construct that we know as the laws of logic? It seems to me that all that is required to accomplish that is the ability to conceptualize things, which I get is part of the category of things covered by this argument, the claim being that our consciousness and ability to think requires the existence of God and souls, but again, I just don't see why. As cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker put it, if we opened up our heads and found that our brains were incredibly simple, clearly incapable of carrying out the complex processes required for consciousness and thought, then that would be evidence that more is required. But as any creationist will be happy to tell you, the human brain is one of the most complex biological systems in all of nature. It stands to reason that a complex system can carry out complex tasks. And what's more, again to borrow from Dr. Pinker, every aspect of consciousness has a physical correlate. We would not expect this to be the case if we rely on a god or a soul to provide consciousness to us, as those things are definitionally immaterial and so would not have physical correlates. As soon as they become physical, they cease to be immaterial. And in one of the most asinine statements he's made so far in this book, and that's really saying something here, is that you can't go to the grocery store and buy 2 pounds of logic, as if whether or not something has its basis in the material world would be determined by whether or not you can buy it at a grocery store. Like, you also can't go to the grocery store and buy 2 pounds of enriched uranium, but I don't think anyone would argue that enriched uranium is immaterial. I understand what he's going for, but it's just a silly thing to say that doesn't actually accomplish anything towards supporting his point. Now, he now claims that atheists use immaterial logic and reasoning to prove that an immaterial god cannot exist, which is somehow supposed to be a problem? I don't understand why that's a problem. The difficulty of proving a negative aside, you can prove or disprove material things by using other material things. Like, if you claim that you saw me win the lottery, money is a material thing. I could disprove that by materially showing you all of my bank account balances. And assuming that we have a way of verifying that I don't have any secret accounts that I was keeping hidden from you, I now have used the material bank statements to disprove the existence of material lottery money in my account. Would that be a problem because I'm using a material thing to disprove another material thing? No, it wouldn't be. He now busts out the classic line that the atheist must borrow from the Christian worldview to prove that the Christian worldview is impossible. But once again, he doesn't explain why. We're just supposed to know that logic and reason come from God. There's no need to elaborate. Never mind that God violates the laws of logic in multiple ways. Now, at this point, I should give a basic background. The laws of logic are as follows. The first one is the law of contradiction. You cannot have a proposition that is both true and false at the same time. So, like, P and not P cannot both be true. The second law of logic is the law of the excluded middle, which is if a proposition is made, that proposition is either true or false. There's no middle ground. And the third law is the law of identity, which is basically a thing is identical to itself. A equals A. If we take a look at my favorite diagram of the Trinity, we can assign letters to each member of the Trinity. The Father can be A, Jesus can be B, the Holy Spirit can be C, and God can be D, because God loves the D. Using the law of identity, we can determine here that A equals D, B equals D, and C equals D. which by extension means that A equals B, A equals C, B equals C, etc., etc., for all, they're all equal to each other. They are all the same thing, according to the law of identity. But then we see from the diagram that A does not equal B or C, B does not equal A or C, and C does not equal A or B. So this violates the law of contradiction, because for all propositions, it is impossible for the proposition to be both true and not true. So for the proposition A equals C, if that is true, then it cannot also be true that A does not equal C. And yet, according to the Trinity, that is the case. And using the law of excluded middle, we can determine that either the proposition A equals C must be true, or it must be false. There is no third option. So, given that the Christian God's very existence violates the laws of logic, can you really say that the atheist has to borrow from the Christian worldview in order to use logic? And at this point, he pulls out the argument for morality, so this gets us our first new bingo square for this chapter. He makes the claim that morality is immaterial and therefore outside the domain of atheistic worldviews. But at this point, I think I should make a distinction that he is obviously unaware of. You see, atheism is not the proposition that the material world is all that exists. It's just the answer to the question, do you believe that a god or gods exist? There are atheists who believe in souls. There are atheists who believe in ghosts. There are atheists who believe in reincarnation. The only qualification there is to call yourself an atheist is to answer the question, do you believe that God exists, with a no. So even if you had a valid point here that a materialist or naturalist cannot account for the immaterial thing that is morality, that doesn't necessarily apply to atheists. But of course, you don't have a valid point. It's perfectly easy to account for moral precepts and laws in atheism. The easiest way to accomplish that is to simply observe the fact that different people from different cultures can have incredibly varied senses of morality, which gives us the impression that there are no universal moral precepts or laws. Morality appears to be the result of nuances of interacting in a society. Now, I'm not going to go into great detail here, but I did make a video specifically about this issue, so I'll leave a link to that if you want a more in-depth analysis of how I think atheists are perfectly able to account for morality. Just as a bit of a teaser to pique your interest in that video, my favorite bit about the moral argument coming from Christian apologists is that when you ask them about the various genocides that God both commanded and committed in the Bible, they waste no time in completely abandoning what they claim is their source of morality in order to borrow from secular consequentialist morality to make God's actions seem more palatable to modern readers who have a very different sense of morality from the people who wrote the Bible. And once again, Pastor Dickey tries to give us whiplash by pivoting suddenly to a misrepresentation of a debate between presuppositional apologist Dr. Greg Bahnsen and Dr. Gordon Stein, where he claims that Dr. Bahnsen's opening statement set forth a presuppositional argument for God's existence that took Dr. Stein completely off guard and left him unable to answer for what he says is the obvious reason. The obvious reason being that atheists cannot account for non-material things like ideas, logic, morality, and cognition. After having listened to the first bit of the debate, Dr. Bahnsen does use presuppositionalist tactics, like the transcendental argument for God, but the thing that took Dr. Stein by surprise was not his use of a very typical argument that anyone who debates apologists has heard a million times before, but rather that Dr. Bahnsen came out saying that he would argue for the existence of the Christian God specifically, rather than just the concept of God in general. And he did answer that, by explicitly defining the concept of God that he was arguing against, and then arguing against it. I'm going to move on from this part, but I do just want to point out that the presuppositionalist apologists are fully aware that their position rests on assertions that are completely unproven and unfounded by playing this clip from Dr. Bahnsen's opening statement of the debate.
He has assumed it in advance, accepting and rejecting all further factual claims in terms of that controlling and unproven assumption. Now, the theist does the very same thing, don't get me wrong.
Back to Pastor Dickey, he now reiterates that belief in an immaterial God is unthinkable for those who maintain that only the material world exists, which is an interesting statement coming from someone who says that they believe that atheists actually do secretly believe in God. It seems like he'd want to avoid pointing out that belief in God is unthinkable to people that he asserts already do believe in God. He then uses a lengthy quote from Michael Robinson, reiterating that atheists have to borrow from Christianity to explain things that don't make sense from a Christian perspective for reasons I already explained. Then we get a quote within a quote, as Robinson quotes C.S. Lewis as having said, "I believe in God as I believe that the sun has risen, not because I see it, but because by it I see everything else." Which is an interesting quote, because the thing is, You can just look at the sun. It's not advisable to look directly at it, but there are safe ways to do that, and even without those ways, you still can indirectly see it. So now imagine that we live in a world that receives its light from an unknown and undetectable source. Would we still conclude that the sun exists? Picture a society that develops on a planet with constant thick cloud cover, thick enough that you can't see that there is a source of light behind the clouds, but not so thick as to leave the planet in constant darkness. Before that society develops the ability to fly above the clouds and see that they are orbiting a star, what do you think they would conclude about their light source? Because I don't think that they'd spontaneously come up with the idea of a sun. So we really do believe in the sun not because it provides light to see other things by, but because we can see where that light comes from. We can see the sun. The next quote he introduces by saying that this apologist, who he doesn't name, made these observations about the inability of atheism to account for existence itself, which gives us a second bingo square of this chapter, the cosmological argument. And I'm not terribly interested in the argument itself at this point. It's just the regular old cosmological argument presented as though the position of atheism automatically comes with the position that the universe created itself out of nothing. And in typical Pastor Dickey fashion, he completely misses the point that the person he was quoting is trying to make. He quotes the argument up to the point where we have an admission that everything that exists needs a cause, and the universe exists, so it must need a cause too, with a follow-up that this cause either has to be personal or impersonal in nature. What he forgets to do is continue on to the various attempts that have been made over the years to remove this argument from the realm of special pleading. At this stage, we can just say, okay, well, if God exists, then he needs a cause. And that never gets addressed. He didn't even finish the quote to the point where it actually explained why the cause of the universe has to be personal. He stops right after explained why the universe has to have a beginning in the atheist worldview, basically thermodynamics. But like I said, that doesn't interest me at this point. What does interest me is the fact that the apologist that he's quoting here, and seems to be too embarrassed to say his name in the main text of the book, is none other than Matt Slick of CARM. I expected to see some familiar names being quoted, like Frank Turek or William Lane Craig, but I never in a million years expected that I'd see Matt Slick's name pop up. After the Matt Slick quote, which is somehow both so long that a more concise quote probably should have been selected, while still not even managing to finish making the point that Pastor Dickey seems to think it was making, we then get to the story of Anthony Flew, where it is said that a well-known British atheist, Anthony Flew, who later came to reject atheism, which, at this point, I'd like to point out once again, if he rejected atheism, then with the implication of how the word reject was used earlier in the book, that means that Anthony Flew really believed in atheism for his whole life. He just came to reject it because he wanted to not sin, I guess? And then he goes into a discussion of Flew's parable, and rather than getting the parable from Flew's writings, he gets the paraphrase of the parable as presented by apologist R.C. Sproul, which turns out to be somewhat important, as Dr. Sproul makes key changes to the parable. In its original form, the parable is that two explorers come across a clearing in the woods. In the clearing, there are flowers growing, but also weeds. One explorer concludes that there must be a gardener tending the clearing, otherwise there wouldn't be flowers. The other disagrees, because the weeds are evidence that nobody's tending it. So they perform a bunch of experiments to try and find the gardener. They stake out the clearing, they surround it with barbed wire, they electrify the wire, etc., etc. Every time they fail to find the gardener, the explorer who thinks there is a gardener comes up with a new excuse as to why they can't find them. They're invisible, that's why we didn't see them. They're intangible, that's why they don't get caught on the barbed wire, etc., etc. The conclusion of the parable is that there is likely no gardener. To use Flew's turn of phrase, the gardener has died the death of a thousand qualifications. God, Flew argued at the time, has died the same death. Every time a skeptic points out a problem with the God claim, a reason can be invented to explain away that problem in a post hoc fashion. Why is there evil? Free will. What about suffering that isn't related to free will, like natural disasters? God has a plan. His ways are just so far above our ways that we can never hope to comprehend them, etc. Sproul, on the other hand, tweaks the analogy ever so slightly in order to make the explorer who believes in the gardener come out in a more favorable light. He says that the explorers come across a clearing with no weeds and flowers planted in rows of perfect symmetry. Sproul concludes his version by saying, "Though no gardener could be found, the presence of the garden itself remains a nagging issue begging for an explanation." And I would agree. The explanation isn't necessarily automatically a gardener, but if we found a clearing in the middle of the jungle that was perfectly cultivated like that, I would want to know how that clearing came about. But Sproul is taking an analogy that is supposed to make it clear that the God hypothesis is unfalsifiable and turned into a teleological argument, an argument from design, thereby missing the point of the analogy entirely. If we wanted to use it as an argument from design, then I need only ask about the myriad of naturally occurring things that seem not only to have happened without design, but would be bad design if they actually were designed, like the laryngeal nerve, to cite the typical example, which has to travel from the base of the brain down through the chest and then back up to the throat in order to innervate the larynx, which it could have done with a nerve significantly shorter than the one that exists. Now, if you'll permit me, I'm going to read the last paragraph verbatim. Pastor Dickey concludes, "Anthony," and again, he's saying Anthony instead of Antony, small problem, but he keeps doing it. "Anthony Flew's parable mocked the idea of an impersonal and immaterial gardener. What good would such a gardener be?" Of course, he was attacking the concept of the Christian God. Flew's purpose for his parable was to draw attention to the ludicrous idea of an impersonal and immaterial God. But as R.C. Sproul pointed out, the garden itself is proof of the value of such a gardener. I don't know if it's even possible for him to have missed the point any harder than he did here. It's not a question of the value of the gardener, but of the very existence of the gardener and the nature of the evidence for that existence. How many excuses does one have to make when the gardener consistently fails to appear before they are justified in not believing that the gardener even exists in the first place? That was the point of the parable, not mocking the very concept of the Christian God based solely on the fact that he's immaterial. In fact, I'd take it a step further. To go in the same direction as R.C. Sproul did, we are told by the people who believe in the gardener that there should be perfectly even and symmetrical rows of flowers with no weeds. But instead, we see just the normal clearing with seemingly random mixtures of flowers and weeds. The excuse is that one of our ancestors didn't listen to the gardener, and so the gardener cursed the garden, so now anytime there's a flower, that's thanks to the gardener, and anytime there's a weed, that's clearly because of the curse. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Dan Nolte, who says, "Forget the book, I want to know about your dog." Okay, fair point. Her name is Puddles, she's a 9-month-old Cocker Spaniel Poodle mix, and she escaped from me after I gave her a bath today, but before I was done drying her, at which point she decided to dry herself on my bed. I did wrangle her in eventually, at which point she then went into spa mode and just enjoyed being pampered. She also has this tendency to make direct eye contact with you while she's peeing on the floor, only to run and hide right afterwards because she knows she's not supposed to do that. I also suspect that she's conspiring with my partner to force me into getting rid of the living room carpet because, well, my partner has always hated that carpet, and now it smells like pee because of someone, so it has to go. I guess Puddles is actually a pretty good name for her, all things considered. She's not smelly today, at least, because she just had a bath. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon and sponsorships manager, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Whiskey Tech Fred, and all the rest, who are the clearing full of weeds and flowers that proves the existence of the gardener that is my channel. If you'd like to actually just be any old forest clearing, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!